It's you, Barbara.
Stop it.
How will we make it?
Maybe we should. Why don't we just...
What did you see, Clary? What did you see?
Boy.
I like to remember things my own way.
Remember me.
Reasonably unhinged.
Yes. Hello and welcome to another episode of Reasonably Unhinged. I am Heiner and today I am alone in the studio for the first time. Some last minute people jumping off, but that's just all right because Hitchcock and specifically the movie we're discussing today, Strangers on a Train, is something I can talk about for an hour alone, probably. We might have Flo joining us later on. I think he'll catch up to the studio and then you won't have to listen to me talk about it for an hour on end, beside the little bit of music we are going to be playing from the film, because the soundtrack is also kind of iconic, like most things about this movie. And about the director, maybe I'll get started by doing a quick rundown of my experience with the big guy, Alfred Hitchcock. He is sort of one of the first old-timey movie guys I became familiar with, in part due to his ubiquity, of course. He is sort of synonymous with filmmaking, with the job of a director, I would say. You could say that maybe these days directors like Christopher Nolan inhabit this role of the archetypal filmmaker. In the 90s, it was probably Quentin Tarantino who was the one director that everyone was kind of familiar with. But Alfred Hitchcock sort of towers above all these generational stars in the directing field, I would say. And almost every one of these later directing stars have some kind of homage to pay to the grandmaster of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. I think the first movie I saw of his wasn't even that great of a film. It was Rope, which sort of intrigued me due to its premise, which especially back when I watched it, there wasn't that many movies yet being made in this sort of one single take fashion, which has become very popular, I would say, at this point. Birdman is probably one of the biggest examples of that ilk, but of course there are so many more. Victoria, the German movie, but yeah, many more. At this point it's become a big gimmick to make a movie more flashy. There's actually one fantastic film that's filmed in one take that doesn't really fall into the trap that many others do. It works really well. And now I have to remember its title because it is a very cerebral title. What was it? The Body Remembers. And then it goes on. It's a Berlinale movie. I'll have the details for you later on as a follow-up. But yeah, Rope had this sort of concept of and then another murder, of course. It's in the middle of Alfred Hitchcock's career. And it is a movie that takes place in just one location and is constructed in a way that it looks like this aforementioned technique of a one single take movie. But of course, back in the day, you couldn't really do single take. Nowadays, you just slap a huge hard drive on your camera and you can film for 2 hours on end. But back then, of course, these actual film stock cameras, you had to exchange the film roll every couple minutes. And in order to account for that, Rope had some nifty techniques. They just basically pointed the camera at some curtains or something and went black, and then there was the cut and you didn't really
notice it, or yeah, you could maybe notice it if you look closely, but it was pretty well hidden. But nonetheless, it wasn't really a complete knockout. You could see that the director of this film was very, very good at what he did, but at the same time, it didn't really knock me over. But that was only the start of my love career with Hitchcock, the big guy. And I would say the biggest sort of moment where I became a fan was Rear Window, because it was just the perfect sort of thriller that I needed at that moment. It was about being stuck in a place and then having to use voyeurism, basically, to get the answers you seek for. But just as I'm talking about Rear Window, we have Flo joining us in the studio. Flo, how are you doing?
Okay.
You seem out of breath a little bit. Did you hurry over?
Yeah, I'm coming straight from work.
I see. And you caught some rain on the way, it seems.
Yeah, it started to rain a little bit more.
Yeah. Unfortunate. But now you're here in the dry studio and we're discussing Strangers on a Train.
Yes.
What was your first impression?
My first impression begins like a few years back when I didn't watch the movie, but watched crime series episodes based on Strangers on a Train. Ah. Basically, the plot twist on there was one Bones episode where like the plot twist is that not connected people kill someone for somebody else. So it was at the end, it was a big reveal. Oh, they met on a train. Mm. They were the strangers on a train.
Wow. I think Patricia Highsmith should have probably sued Bones because, or maybe they actually paid her.
As far as I know, there are many crime TV
it's
series.
A very
and
popular
they use
trope.
The trope.
Yes.
And I think it's also a pretty cool trope.
But, yes.
And that's where it came to my first thought. Before beginning of the film, I was not that hyped because I thought the movie will make a big plot twist out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, let's see how they do it because how Hitchcock has done it, because I already know the plot twist. And then I was like, oh, it's not a twist.
It's not about that.
It's basically just like right from the beginning.
Yeah.
The premise of the movie is like people meeting in a train and
immediately Bruno,
suggests
our main character has his plan all laid out to our other main character, Guy. So Guy,
best name, Guy.
He is also a guy, like he is the weakest link of this film by far, I would say. He is an extremely wooden actor. his presence was very different from all the other actors, I felt like. It sort of worked because he is this sort of rube, this sort of very sheltered person who seems to only have been on the tennis court all his life.
Yeah, I think I also think he's like the main guy, not like Bruno. Bruno's like the antagonist, I think, I would
to
say.
To me, but Bruno's in this movie, the antagonist is the main guy, to me at least, because Guy is such a weak presence also. I mean, Hitchcock sort of saw what he's working with, and in my mind he did great to focus his attention almost entirely on Bruno and on a lot of other secondary characters who are great in the film.
I'm not sure about that, because I think I think Guy worked perfectly at what he wanted to be. He's like, he is like that sort of like
nothing.
Textbook good guy person, probably, where it's like, I'm a tennis star, I'm famous, but I don't have a personality. And I think that is his character trait, is that he has no character traits, basically.
You can sort of defend it on that front, but I think at the same time, it was a decision of having no alternatives. Like, I think this guy, also this actor, never really got another big job. Like, I think Hitchcock was annoyed. He was also very annoyed at having to cast, what's her name again? The main love interest of...
Anne?
It's Ruth Roman, and she was a contract star for Warner Brothers. And Hitchcock... again, and I think this is one of his first times, but it became a big part of his career, basically psychologically tortured her to get out his frustration on the studio that they had to cast her because he wanted another actress from his own repertoire in that role. But I think she actually does a great job, Ruth Roman. I think she's a great presence in the film, and it is just one of these things, like Alfred Hitchcock is just also a piece of shit, unfortunately.
It's always happening. I just checked for Farley Granger. He in fact did like 55 movies.
Well, back in the day, you could do 100 movies in a year if you wanted.
Hitchcock before.
Yeah, he did.
On Rope.
Yeah, it is. I just talked about Rope. I think Rope is one of his weaker films, one of the weaker films of his I have seen. And here again, Granger is the weakest link.
I have not seen that many Hitchcock movies. Strangers on the Train is like the fourth Hitchcock movie.
Okay, let's go through it.
I watched Psycho.
Yes.
First and foremost,
I just recently caught up. That was surprisingly one of the films I hadn't seen for a long time. But I really loved it.
I watched Vertigo.
Fantastic,
and,
of course.
The Man Who Knew Too Much, but the first one,
that one,
the bad one from 34.
That's a weird choice of yours.
It was available at Prime Video for free.
Yeah.
And I saw Peter Lorre because Peter Lorre plays a role. And I like Peter Lorre.
Of course.
Not because just of M, but he also did like a few movies with Vincent Price where he's like funny guy.
Yes, he is extremely funny presence in.
But I cannot recommend The Man Who Knew Too Much from 34.
I also didn't really have it on my planned viewing list. But that's an interesting roundup of Alfred Hitchcock movies, because you, besides maybe Psycho and Vertigo, you didn't go for the fun movies, North by Northwest, and then the big capers.
Not thrust. Popped up on my radar, or are not that available.
Yes.
So it's not that easy to watch them all.
Yes.
And I did not go there, or did the investment on some Hitchcock Blu-ray collection or something like that.
Actually.
And that's mainly the reason why I didn't watch any more Hitchcock movies, to be honest.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to, that this was very instrumental in my love of movies, that I went to London and got a big sort of DVD box set of, I think, like 6 or 7 Hitchcock films. And back then, I hadn't really watched any movie older than the 80s at that point. And it was just like, this Hitchcock guy, and the thing was cheap. And then I was just completely enamored with Rear Window, and Rope was fine also. But Vertigo and North by Northwest, it's just, I love thrillers, and I think my love for thrillers has come from these early experiences with Hitchcock movies. And so it was a great thing of dipping your toe back into the old pool by going to this Strangers on the Train movie, because it's, you get what you sign up for. You get all the craziness and a lot of humor. I think his sense of humor, this sort of no real winking, but sort of behind your eye winking, sort of almost.
Besides his own cameos, because those are just like winking in the camera. But
barely a joke, I think. They're just like a thing he does.
The cameo was very funny in this movie.
Because he's
on the train and then he just stares into the camera.
Yeah.
And it feels like he's winking at it. And
it's also one of the most sort of pointed cameos. Usually he is in a crowd or just walking quickly by. And here we have him when there is a transfer on the train, entering the train and being the only person in the shot, really, after our
attack. Yeah, with a contrabass, I think.
Some huge music case he's carrying.
I mean, it's very fitting for his own appearance.
It's actually double bass, so it doubly fits the bill.
And then he just stares into the camera and I was like, okay, that's funny, guy.
Yes, it's fantastic. But maybe we'll get into some of what this movie is actually all about, because we've alluded to a lot of it. I prepared a clip for you that basically sums up the whole premise of the movie. So we're going to listen to that right now.
Now, let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
It's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason. Let's say. Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen. It's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
We're coming into my station.
For example, your wife, my father. Crisscross.
What?
Oh, we do talk the same language, don't we?
Well, sure, Bruno, we talk the same language. Thanks for the lunch.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought the lamb chops were a little overdone myself.
Nice meeting you.
Now, you think my theory's okay, Guy? You like it?
Sure, Bruno, sure. They're all okay.
Yeah. So you hear Bruno's theory, Bruno's idea, and you also hear Guy being sort of flippant about it, being like, yeah, just this weird guy I met on the train by chance. I really want to get rid of him. He seems like a bad apple. He also has some great lines right off the bat. He goes, I love people who do things. I really love that line because it immediately gives you this sort of vibe that he is different. That he,
and also he's in for it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. I like to get stuff done.
Yeah. Or he admires people who get stuff done. And he sort of, we find out that he is very much a Nepo baby, that he is the son of a rich guy who he hates, who hates him, and a doting mother who basically protects him from his father.
He's a Nepo baby and he's daddy and mommy issues.
Yes. And like extremely big. So. Yeah, it's an extreme situation with Bruno because, yeah, not only is he like perfectly portrayed, this guy really gives you the creeps right off the bat. He is all in on being, making you uncomfortable almost with his extreme sort of, air about him. And then you have some scenes with the family where you get some idea of where this all might come from. We have a very intimate relationship with the mother. The first scene of them, we have her filing his nails.
Very Oedipus.
Yes, extremely so. They are extremely close up against each other while she is doing his nails and he's being like very particular about them, being like, nah, this is almost perfect, but you're not the best you are usually, mom. And then he kisses her hands and stuff like that. It's very intimate, and the mother seems to also be a little too intimate on the other side. And then on the other hand, you have definitely the father that wants to be killed. So the Oedipal complex situation sort of gets a complete and neat bow wrapped around it. And Bruno is just in the middle of it, and it's just this utter creep who's having the time of his life planning a murder that he doesn't have to do.
He's like, he has like way too much fun.
Yes. I really love that. It comes across and it really is infectious. And you feel like a piece of shit for sort of not admiring, but sort of being in awe of his just weirdness.
That's interesting. It didn't quite catch me that much. I thought it was like super infectious. I didn't. Because, I don't know, I looked in his face and I was like, I don't like this guy.
Him, but I love to hate him. Like,
yeah, but it didn't felt like you could just call it infectious. I did not connect enough with him, really? Or something like that.
No, but, I mean, connecting to him is impossible, I think. He has his own bubble of vibes.
As you just said, talked about him, I remember, like, there's a, I don't know if you know, there's a Batman comic where it's like, it's just a few pages where it's about a guy who just wants to know how it feels to kill. And he just wants to kill somebody. And then there's a few panels and he just shoots Batman in the head and just goes away because he has no motive, no nothing. And as you just talked, I was like, very remember that Bruno could be like inspiring for that kind of character or short comic. Sure. Because he also just feels like, yeah, he hates his father, but also he very much feels like he wants to kill. Just not like, just for the thrill of it, not because of any other really motive. He just wants to know how it feels to kill something or somebody.
We have a little monologue of his early on in the film where he sort of lays it all out that he wants to try everything once. He wants to do the most outlandish things. He wants to be the first person on Mars. He wants to be the first person in space. He wants to go around the world. He wants to basically have done anything that you could imagine. And kill apparently is very high on his list of things he wants to, his bucket list that he is so obsessed about. And that's a weird choice, but a very fitting choice for Bruno, our character, because anytime he makes a decision, it's a little creepy. It's a little more creepy than it has to be. And it's, yeah. I think it's a joy to behold, because you can really see that this actor is in his element. He really enjoys playing this creep.
Maybe a bit too much.
I don't know. I like when people lean into this. But it's a fantastic portrayal of this dude. I think he also has a very tragic life. Is it Robert Walker, right?
Yes, yeah. It's Robert Walker.
Yeah, he unfortunately never really managed to follow up with his success.
I just saw that he died the year Strangers on a Train released.
Yes, he suffered from alcoholism and mental illness, which were exacerbated by a painful separation and divorce at age 30. He died at 32. So a very tragic life, yes, unfortunately. Because, I would love to have seen him in other Hitchcock films. He feels like such a perfect repertory evil guy.
Yeah, I also just thought about he would made like a good Bond villain.
Yes.
Like 20, 30 years later.
Yes.
I could still imagine him like be a very good villain, not particularly Bond, but just any bigger franchise stuff where you have like
Bond is the perfect example because the homoeroticism, which this movie also very much doesn't hide, is
focus on buddies and
And also the intimacy between men being sort of more precious and aestheticized to an extreme degree, that works very well with the male-centric sort of homoerotic nature of a James Bond movie of the 80s or 70s. Strangers on a Train. We are sort of still bobbing about getting you the premise, but maybe we'll dig into the plot a little bit more, because at this point we only know the two have met on the train. Guy is really not into this whole idea, and Bruno basically can't be stopped at this point. You can see in his glimmer in his eyes.
But also the lack of personality in Guy feeds Bruno, because Guy can't really say no. He's not denying the whole idea. He's like, let's sure do it. Just like he belittles him a little bit.
Yeah.
And
Bruno feels the pushover vibes.
And Bruno's just like, I can do this. Yeah. And he just wants to push Guy also to do bad stuff. Like
this is the perfect route for me to get this plan off the ground that I've been thinking for probably for years at this point. And I'm really lucky that I found this sort of charismatic, just no identity, no personality guy who I can push over and into this, who at the same time is of very high status, because as we learn, he is separated from his wife, who is also a fantastic character we'll get to later. And he is having an affair or sort of a relationship that in this sort of society can be seen as an affair, but at the same time seems to be a very healthy, normal relationship with the daughter of a senator. So high status.
It's like, I wouldn't even consider it like a real affair, because everybody knows it, and
everybody's on board.
Moved on, but he's still married with his ex, basically.
Yeah.
But they hadn't done a divorce, and he wants to marry the daughter of the senator, and it's like, he loves her more, basically. And
he loves her.
He loves her.
I think the love is gone between.
Yeah. And also it's like very helpful for him, because when he can't play tennis anymore, it's helpful to marry a daughter of a senator.
Yeah. I mean, he can play tennis still, but also that's
not forever.
Yeah. That's not something that's going to go on forever. And to have a senator on your side is, I think, always a good idea. And he's surprisingly a nice guy. You would think that a senator would have some edges around him, but he's extremely humane, extremely compassionate in the few scenes we see him in.
Yeah, I think that the whole relationship with Guy and his love and her family is like very wholesome.
Extremely so.
So it's like they it's all like each other, nobody so. Hates each other. It's That's, just like
it's almost like a twist in and of itself because we are familiar with how Hitchcock usually operates, and then we have this scene where he first goes into the chambers of the senator, and there's the three people on his side, so to speak, his girlfriend and fiance maybe in the future, Ruth Roman, and the senator himself, and of course one of the other MVPs in the film, at least to me, Patricia Hitchcock, the daughter of Alfred herself, who plays the younger sister of Ruth Roman and is fantastic. She just goes all out. She is, you would say probably today that she is on the spectrum kind of, because she always extremely sort of, feels like I just yell out what I know, what I feel, and what I think.
Yeah, and she's
not aware of social cues, or she doesn't care about them.
She does her thing. She's nerd-coded, particularly with the glasses and how she talks and how she behaves around people. And it's like she knows very much.
Yes.
She yells it out. And with the glasses, she kind of looks like a cliche. She reminded me a little bit of Velma from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, Velma is sort of more emotionally intelligent than her.
Yeah, that's true. But with like
the vibe the optic and the looks, and
the looks
very,
and the vibes are very Velma.
Yeah, I agree. But also she has some fantastic lines. She basically is also kind of a audience surrogate, because she sort of yells out things that we want to shake Guy and tell him.
Especially later in the movie.
Yes, exactly. they are a dynamic team almost. They are immediately in sort of code red mode and sort of lay out the problem. We haven't really gotten to it, but of course, Bruno sort of goes all in very early on. We have first an introduction of the target of Bruno's, because as was alluded to in the clip, this concept of going crisscross with your murders. You do mine, I do yours. And Bruno's murder then has to be for Guy's wife. And Guy's wife is just extreme. We have this one intro of hers at her work where she does a whole sort of production of fucking with Guy, getting him into a booth where they have to, they get to talk in private, flirting with him very sort of directly, and then pulling the rug out from under him after taking his money, saying, oh, that's nice, I'm gonna buy some nice clothes from that, and I'm never gonna divorce you because you got some money coming your way and I ain't getting rid of that.
She feels very much like it's okay to be married to you, because
there's not going to be a downside to me being married to you.
I don't
in the
care
future.
If you love me or not.
Yeah.
Just go fuck yourself. And
I'm gonna have my fun, and I'm gonna get some checks from you, and that's how this arrangement is gonna work. And so we have Guy being irate. Of course, he basically came to her with the plan of giving her money for the divorce lawyer and for the proceedings. And she pulled the rug from under him. And he calls his girlfriend and tells her about it. And, says the sort of ill-advised thing that he could strangle her, which is sort of the biggest emotion that he has to convey in the film almost, I feel like, in a direct sense. And it really, is again a weakness, because I don't buy him really.
I don't know.
Wanting
I think
to strangle
his
her.
Biggest emotions are like later when he feels guilty.
Yeah,
I think because if you can't convey that much emotions, but his guilt you can really see in him, and I think he can deliver that very good.
Nah, so. I don't think so. But
I bought
he does try. I have to give him that. He does try.
He felt like a very rich kid who feels guilty.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like a rich kid would have more sort of going on behind the eyes. There's sort of more, there's more operation going on. He has lived through years and years of operators around him. There would be more depth to his emotion. But anyway, we don't want to harp on poor Guy. He's already been through the ringer in this film. I don't want to make it any worse for him. But I also quickly want to point out another scene with Bruno. I know we're jumping around a lot, but before we go ahead in the plot, there is a neat moment when the mother has been drawing, has been painting on a canvas, and we as the audience don't really see what she's painting. And Bruno comes along, she proudly displays this painting to Bruno, and Bruno just belly laughs extremely intensely. And then we as the audience get to view the painting, and it's like a almost like a Goya painting, an extremely disturbing sort of expressionist, dark horror image. And Bruno says, yeah, you basically got the essence of that. And oh, she's just like, no, I wanted to paint St. Francis, the saint, which, yeah, is just all-out comedy. It's a real, like, direct joke that is built into this film, which I think is wonderful and is, at this point, almost a daring feat to get the villain who is extremely awful to also be a really funny guy.
I mean, it makes him kind of like a comic villain or something like that, because he's very serious, but all the seriousness gets just sometimes there's a little break in it and everybody laughs because he says something stupid or like makes comments like this on a painting of his mother.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, you basically get the essence of dad. Yeah.
I wouldn't even say he's serious. He sort of always bobs and weaves and finds his sort of stream of being in order to fit in with the current situation, and then also relishes with breaking that and going in a harder direction to put people off their feet. He's a real psychopath. He's having fun
he's
fucking
having,
with people.
I just want to say, he's like having too much fun being bad.
Yes, yes. And that's a new thing, I feel like. And that's a Patricia Highsmith thing also. Maybe we quickly have to mention Patricia Highsmith, who is one of the biggest authors of crime fiction, of thrillers. Probably most famously, The Talented Mr. Ripley has been filmed like 4 or 5 times. She's done many of those novels, but she's also done so many other novels that have been turned into movies or TV shows. She is one of the biggest authors in that genre, and she got duped by Alfred Hitchcock, as so many other people in the business did. He basically did negotiations for this novel to be adapted in another name to not have the other party find out that the big Alfred Hitchcock is trying to produce it, and got it for like a couple $1,000 because Patricia Highsmith was early on in her career and she was sort of still needing money and
she was like,
can't
oh, nice.
Hold out for it. Yeah. And basically Patricia Highsmith is still pissed about this for a long time. It left a sour taste in her mouth, understandably. But that's how Alfred Hitchcock operated. He was a very shrewd and not very nice man in many, many respects. But
back to the plot.
Back to the plot. Yeah, we have still a lot of stuff to get to. Where were we? We had, at this point, all the plans laid out, and Guy having had his falling out.
We met Miriam.
We met Miriam. I love her. She's great.
She was fine.
Nah, she's fantastic. Because apparently she had perfect eyesight, and Alfred Hitchcock insisted on putting real glasses on her with huge distortion to her eyes. And so she basically was blind throughout the whole filming of the film. And if you consider that, she really puts in the work. She really does a lot with not being able to navigate in that sense.
Yeah.
And Bruno, now it's Bruno's time to meet Miriam.
Yeah, they like, if I remember correctly, it's like on some kind of fair.
Yes.
There's a love there's like this ride.
I have some
there's a love tunnel
on that as well.
Something like that. And then there's like excellent shadow work, because you don't actually see the thing per se, you see only shadows and what's happening.
It's still quoted to this point as like one of the big Alfred Hitchcock scenes. Like everything on that fairground is impressive on some level, on some technical level.
Yeah, and I think the shadow thing is like, I'm not sure if it's particularly from this movie, but I think it's like something that's like quoted a lot or referenced, like this kind of work
for sure.
Other things happen in other movies when they use like the shadows like this.
Yes, it's a thing that happens throughout this film. Shadow and light are always sort of motifs that have are being reused and reinterpreted in different senses, different fashions in the film.
It's a black and white movie, so it's like
it's easy to do. Yeah,
it's a little bit easier to do in a black and white movie.
You have a leg up on it.
Work with contrast and stuff.
Exactly, but yeah, the amusement park they go to is called Kraft's 20 Big Shows, and it was created by a guy named Kraft, and it actually got out of commission in the 60s, so it didn't really have that much of a long lifespan after this film. But it is iconic both for this film and its Ferris wheel scene we'll get to later on, but also the whole fairground experience we get in this arena, and for a Elvis Presley movie where he is sort of prominently going to a fairground. And again, we have Kraft's 20 Big Shows amusement park. You can't really find a lot on him and on Kraft and the whole amusement park, because I was very fascinated by how sort of accurate the scenes are, in that you could visit every attraction you see there, or if they sort of tinkered with it a little bit to make it more cinematic. But apparently, no, it's really all taken from this fairground itself. And it probably has to have been a great marketing tool for Kraft at that point, at least, because you have some shots of his name on the marquee on the entrance to the fairground.
Seems like a good part of, what's it called? Product placement.
Yes. A very, very early instance of product placement. And yeah, the fairground is then the scene of the crime, as you alluded to. Here I also have a little interesting and fun fact, because we do follow her, what's her name again?
Miriam
around with her two lovers or friends. We aren't really completely sure, but I think the movie heavily should suggest that these two men are sort of in a love relationship.
I mean, would make sense to make like the bad woman in the movie more promiscuous than the good wife material woman, especially for the time.
Of course. And also with a homoerotic sense of like, nah, this is all a secondary thoughts. We're here for the guys. Anyway, she goes from attraction to attraction in this fairground, and Bruno does no real work to obscure his gazing presence on her.
He's not a good stalker.
Well, it depends on what the goal of stalking is. I don't know. He's very efficient, let's say.
Yeah.
He doesn't lose her and he gets to his goal. But in the process, we have some nice attractions. We have the old, in German it's called Howden Lucas. I actually have no idea what it's called in English. The hammer you hit on the thing and it goes up. And there we have a fairground operator screaming that you can win a Cupid doll. And this perked my ears. I don't know if you are familiar with the term Cupid. Have you heard of it before?
Nope.
It's these weird little baby dolls that actually a woman created and became one of the richest women back in the day. It's a big entrepreneurial story. These dolls have weird configuration of their arms, and they look like cherubic little babies with smooth everything.
Okay.
And at this point, they have no presence in pop culture anymore, except for one big product placement, and that is Cupid Mayo, the sort of only mayo and biggest mayo first mayo that was produced in Japan. And the Japanese producer basically saw these 60s weird dolls and thought this is a nice mono sort of symbol that he could slap onto his product. And at this point,
That's why it's called Kewpie
Mayo. This little baby on the thing used to be a doll in America, and then
That's also why they named it Kewpie Mayo.
Yes, to have
that's,
this cute
that's
little doll.
That's very fun. Okay, yeah. By the way, the name for Howden Lucas in English is High Striker Ring the Bell, the Strongman Game.
Strongman game, yeah, boring.
Or High Striker Ring the Bell or so.
A rare instance where the German language has a sort of more memorable phrase for it. I don't want to argue that. Anyway, Kewpie also, I'm not done with my little Kewpie excursion. Kewpie also is a fun little, misspelling, not really, because it is sort of a spelling out of Q and P, by going Kawpie instead of Q, the letters Q and P. And it's an allusion to, again, cherubism and the little baby, what's he called, with a...
Cupid?
Yeah, Cupid. Cupid.
Yeah, I thought about my when you mentioned Cupid, I was like, is it
exactly
a Cupid doll or something
exactly
like that?
Okay. But in a very fun sort of way, yeah. Exactly. And then we have finally Bruno catching up to her in this very spacious, very high production value. What do you
tunnel
call them?
Love,
tunnel
right?
of love.
Tunnel of love.
Attraction. Yes.
It's like a boat ride.
Yeah.
A small boat ride.
Yeah, but no real tunnel, just like a huge lake that you get to go on. A little bit of a tunnel.
There was a small tunnel.
Yeah.
And I think it's very impressive that it's like on this kind of fair.
Yeah.
Because it's like not stationary, I think. It's
a huge lake. I don't know how they produced it.
Yeah, they just
built it up.
Yeah. Because I get water rides in parks, they are stationary, where it's like, okay, we just built this.
You have to do a lot of work to get
all the thing.
That bigger pool going.
Yeah, but when it's moving, it's like, okay, how do you do it? And what the fuck?
and why put so much effort into such a, like...
Because people who are in love can spend like a lot of money probably.
Yeah, but is it really expensive? I don't know.
Not that much, but it's like, yeah. I think it's something that attracts many people.
Yeah, apparently. So, I mean, I get it. It's if they
all the couples want to go there.
They go around the fairground. They see like half of the fairground is this huge lake. You want to see what that's all about.
It's a lake in the dark where you can touch.
Of course. No, but you can do that behind the Ferris wheel or whatever.
It's not that romantic.
I see. I don't know. I think both have their romanticism to them. Then we have the kill.
The murder.
The one kill.
The good old strangling.
Yeah. It's quick, but it's elegant. It's extremely well executed. I was in awe. Yeah.
Execute. Uh-huh.
Very well. Very well. Thank you very much. And she has no idea what hits her. And Bruno is very proficient. He goes and it's done in no time. And he's also, like, for making him out to be an operator, he also is kind of dumb. Like, he's lucky in many moments and in many regards.
Yes, if I remember correctly, he just sneaks onto her boat.
No.
Right. Isn't it on the boat?
He goes on a separate boat, and then they go across, and then they get off on the other side, and he gets out, and there's like some shrubs and stuff you can sort of hide behind, some greenery, and he basically says, hey, you come over here, and then it's done. The two guys are just scrambling around there, and he gets to escape just
very
out
lucky
of sheer luck. Yeah.
The other guys
don't see him,
don't recognize him.
Exactly.
When he lures her to him.
It's not a master plan at all. It's almost like a crime of passion, because he really has no preparations made. He's just lucky he gets to get away. And also he drops the lighter, which is another part of it.
Yeah, but he's
sort of
very confident.
Yeah.
And he's like, I really want to do it. He's like straightforward.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, it just goes to show, like, if you really wanted to cooperate with Guy, just let's suss this out. Let's talk about it and let me tell you when I'm going to do it so you get to have an airtight alibi. But no, he just wanted to kill and he wanted to do it as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's not as thoughtful as you might think it is.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the whole, as you just said, if you really both parties want to plan this through, you just plan how you yourself... get a airtight alibi, and when the other person is doing it, so he's just like, no, he's when I said he just wants to kill.
Yeah.
He's...
This is the not, thin veil yeah, he yeah. gets to put over his just
its own,
bloodlust.
Yeah, yeah. He uses the whole complot just as a cover for his bloodthirst.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it works surprisingly well. He gets off scot-free. Nobody's the wiser. And he also, and he's very proud of that, and he reiterates it many times, that he drops the lighter that he took off Guy, or that Guy lost and he kept on the train. And it's laying beside her, and we feel like, oh, he's going away and that's going to be a red herring. It's going to be found by the police. But no, he goes back to it and picks it back up. Meanwhile, at any moment, someone could have caught him. It's a very...
Yeah, I mean, my main thought, also in the end of the movie and the like whole who did it when the police comes and everything, I was like, yeah, this only works like back in the days.
Yeah.
It would not have worked like 20 years later or today, not even close.
No.
Because of like all the forensics and stuff we get and like everything else, surveillance on
of course.
Fairs like that and everything. It really feels like a plot that would not work today.
No. But it's fine because it does work, because you do get the environment. You see why it would work.
It's the late 40s, early 50s. It's like, okay, police work is not that
We delicate. Also get a glimpse on that.
Yeah,
because
it's not that delicate. It's just like you have to ask people. There's not like many forensic details and
it's many the husband is the murder. Always. Yeah. Always. And that's also how
easy.
The cops in this movie operate. They are like, it's a weird, weird situation, because why would somebody kill her on the ferry? But it has to be the man. It has to be the husband.
Yeah.
There's no
alternative. He has like... He gets benefits from it. He's like, and then we don't need to do any investigation. No. He just did it.
Let's just
and we know it.
Hire 10 policemen who observe him around the clock. And then we're just going to find him red-handed as he's trying to kill again. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's very bad police work, but it doesn't really go out of its way to be wrong about it. It makes sense to you. That
kind of, I mean,
they seem like idiots.
For me, like, was the weakest part of the movie, the whole police.
The police aren't really
how they,
interesting.
How the plot goes forward from when the police are involved, because it feels...
They aren't really
kind of
interesting idiots.
Yeah.
They are just idiots, boring idiots.
Yeah, they don't feel like really into their work.
Yeah.
It's just like, normally you have like policemen or police people who are like, okay, we... want to solve murders or we want to solve crime, and they just feel like, fuck it, just it's
guess
we already know
have
this
to do that. Okay,
they don't want to investigate or anything.
Guy also mentioned that he wants to get into politics, where I was thinking like, okay, this kind of airhead is like the perfect figurehead you can manipulate into doing
especially
really anything. He's like the perfect Democratic senator who would just like, have 20 people behind him doing the bidding for him, while he's just like always having a stare and 2,000 yards, not thinking anything.
He just looks good.
Yeah.
And he's charming. And
he
that's
does
like,
look good. I don't know if he's actually charming.
I thought he felt very charming for all the people around him.
Yeah, the people certainly do their best to make you feel like he's charming, but I didn't really get the charm.
I could get behind it.
Okay.
It's not like that he charmed me so much, but it's like...
Doing
I can,
the heavy lifting.
I definitely understand why he would work as any political party member and be like a representative for something, because he just like, somebody writes him a speech, he can read it properly, I think.
Probably.
And he just stands there, has the good looks. People are like, oh yeah, we trust him. He's like, he looks like a perfect nice guy.
Yeah.
And people would just eat out of his hand.
Yeah. And also, I can understand where Ruth Roman would be in a relationship, because she's always the stronger person. Like, basically, he has no... Like, he's a good-looking guy, and he's just an idiot. But anyway, we're already in the last 10 minutes, so let's jump ahead and quickly mention that there's another murder. But no, maybe we'll wait. The police shoot the operator of the Ferris wheel, which arguably is an even worse
I don't
kill.
Remember the Ferris wheel.
The Ferris
the
wheel.
Carousel.
No, it's the carousel. I'm an idiot. Of course.
I was confused why you mentioned the Ferris wheel multiple times because the finale of the movie is on a carousel.
No,
it's not
the carousel. Yeah, yeah. You're right.
I'm sorry. I was like, where's that? Did
and
I
then
sleep
it's
sometime?
Just absolutely fantastic.
It's Ferris wheel. So crazy.
Yeah, nobody died while filming
it. Because
there's no CGI or anything.
They did not feel like film noir thriller, 50s thriller finale. It felt like something comically,
thriller.
Something Mission Impossible would do. Or, or even a Final Destination death scene
daring.
Would start like this with the carousel starting to get out of hand, spinning faster and faster.
Yes.
And people are on it and get thrown off and everything went crazy.
It's crazy.
And you sit there and it's like, it's the 50s. How the fuck did you do? Because, there are camera people on the carousel because there are shots from the carousel when it starts to getting faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
And somebody has to crouch under the carousel to stop it.
That's a fantastic thing. And not just anyone. The craziest looking guy.
A
carny who looks like... Yeah, he's a carny.
Yeah, he's
a carny
kind of a
mechanic.
Yeah. he works the mechanics on the carnival, I think.
Yeah.
I think they mentioned someone who can do it
or
who knows how to get around, and that's the person. And he also
because they shot the guy who was operating it. The fucking police. They have no
because the police are goddamn idiots in this movie.
Yeah, extremely so.
And he looks like he was just operating another ride and had to go over. It's not an actor or anything.
Yes,
just be like. You now have to stop this while there's a carousel spinning, like, what's it called?
What's it called? Kaiser. Spinning top.
Yeah, the spinning top and going faster and faster.
It's
and
insane. Like, he's, crouching and very slowly and deliberately crouching under this Ferris wheel that's going 100 miles an hour and, could kill him at any point. It's incredible. And the shots we get of him, like, face first, just approaching the camera, it's fantastic.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's like, how did they... camera there because cameras back then are big.
Extremely
how did
so,
they put cameras on the carousel? And
it's a marvel too.
Yeah, and then you see from the outside how fast they go by and how fast it really is, and you're like, okay,
that's
people are getting thrown off because
safe.
It's too fast. This is something. I mean, they could do something like
you
this
see
today
some speeding
CGI.
Up of the
but the footage,
at the same time that. Doesn't really explain away how you can do it.
Yeah, and it felt very over the top, I think, for like how the tone of the rest of the movie was. Yes, the villain, Bruno, is over the top, kind of,
but
just as a person and as a personality.
He also pushes a kid away from a carousel, which was a great touch.
Fitting.
Yeah, perfect.
but the whole physicality of the finale is like, it feels like it's not fitting in this kind of movie, but it fits perfectly.
To me,
Yeah.
For sure. He also pops the balloon at the first visit where he goes for the kill before he gets to kill. He also
hates kids.
Yeah, it's perfect all the way. Maybe we'll do some quick connection of what we're talking about right now to the rest of the plot because we did jump very hard.
Yeah.
At this point, the both of them are in this sort of spiel of how much do we reveal, and Guy does visit Bruno at his house. Sort of intending to kill the father, but then actually intending to tell the father about the scheme. And
but the father's not there. Bruno's waiting for him.
Of course, it was a double cross by Bruno. It's actually a triple cross.
It's not really a double cross because Guy just acts too fast. He's on the phone with Bruno telling him he wants to kill his father tonight.
Yeah.
And he just... hangs up the phone before Bruno can tell him his father is not there tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So Bruno is just like, okay, let's wait and see what happens. Or kind of smells like the betraying of Guy,
and
I think.
Gets the trip across in there.
And gets in there and is like, oh, you actually didn't let me tell you that my dad is not here.
Yeah.
So, and then he's like...
You're never going to get rid of me, baby.
Yeah, and then he tries to frame... Guy with the lighter.
Yes.
On the murder.
He basically makes it clear that he has his life dangling in front of him. He's in charge and Guy can't do nothing about it. And it all culminates, as I've said, in this this scene because the police are already willing to take him in. It's like, oh, we have enough. Yeah. He's the husband. That's all the proof we need. And he, but they still are even dumber. And therefore they decide, yeah, let him play his tennis match before the finish line, so to speak. And we have this incredible shot that gets quoted a lot too, where all the audience follows the tennis match in the typical fashion where they bob their head back and forth looking at the ball. And meanwhile, Bruno sits in the middle of this crowd and stares straight ahead towards Guy. And it is a really unsettling thing, underscored by some great music.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's a scramble because now Bruno is taking off, finding the lighter to be stuck in a grate. He has to fish the lighter from below a sewer grate. And in the same time, we see the last sort of ball exchanges in the tennis match in a very sort of modern montage fashion. It gets shot back and forth between the action. And at the same time...
Like a tennis match. It's just like a tennis match.
Yeah, exactly. Challengers code.
Yeah.
And at this point, the police and Guy, everyone is headed back to the fair. We have a great shot of Penn Station, one of the most beautiful buildings in America, this very bombastic, huge train station. And we go to the fairground and have this madcap a finale at the Ferris wheel where, Bruno tries to get still out of this situation. And at the same time, he doesn't even know how lucky he is that the police are not even interested in him.
Yeah.
Until we get the final reveal, which was a little cheap because you did see at the first scene where the kill happens, this guy operating the tunnel of love being like, huh, this guy, I'm going to have a look at him. And then anyway, continue the movie. And then at the end, he comes back and manages to point out on the Ferris wheel, no, actually, Bruno, that's the guy who came.
I'm sorry.
To me, it's just a Ferris wheel now.
It's a wheel.
It's a wheel. It's
another direction.
Nope.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the final sort of nail in the coffin. The police are still awestruck. They're like, oh, are you really, really, really sure?
I mean,
because
as far as I remember.
I don't know if you know this, but he is the husband, not Bruno.
Yeah, but the lighter is like really important because it's always like, who has the lighter must be guilty. I can't even remember why. Exactly.
It makes no sense. Because the police had never seen the lighter
something.
At that point. No.
The only thing
you could say is that this definitely belongs to Guy. So if it's found at the body or found in some sort of way that would implicate him, Bruno could do something about it. But there's no like smoking gun quality to it. It's just
not a picture where the lighter is.
It just looks great. And it's a great sort of MacGuffin because it looks cool as he's taking it out of the grate and basically almost like killing his arm while going
down. And then
down
there's like the end where I think he fell from the carousel when it stopped. Hit his head or something.
Yes.
And is like laying there and police is still
not
sure.
He's sort of in the rubble of it. He's buried in pieces
and then
of carousel.
In his last breaths and police are still like, Guy, are you really sure this is the guy, is the person? And they only believe him when Bruno dies and his hand opens to reveal the light. And it feels kind of cheesy, but it's also
very theatrical.
And it's like overly theatrical, but it's cool. It's just like
it's a cool
shot with the lighter in the hand. And
I loved it.
It's like you see how his life leaves his body when his hand opens.
Yes, and we get to have this little camera moving down from his face to his hand. Yeah. The hand slowly up. It's
and then the police are like,
beautiful.
Okay, he wasn't.
Ah, turns out we were kind of wrong, but we're not going to talk about that.
No.
Yeah, the police are very, very bad in this movie, but it's something that I appreciated. Some final words. We are in our last minute of the hour. Again, I want to shout out the Carney, who was fantastic. He has a face I loved. And yeah, him being the operator being shot, that was a real shock to me. It's just like they immediately start shooting the police. They immediately in the open
it's
fairground.
America, it's America. It's okay.
Yeah,
I want to shout out the short shorts of guy playing tennis and the Hitchcock cameo because I really like that. I thought it was very funny.
Thanks, Flo, for joining me again and sort of rescuing this, not being a one person show at this point. And we'll see you next week with a new movie.
Yeah, hopefully so. Do my best.
Bye.
Bye.